from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Cleopatra's Death by Viper, Romeo and Juliet and the Deadly Vial, the cyanide-laced Kool-Aid in Jonestown, arsenic and old lace, anthrax and ricin in letters to Washington. The stories, real and imagined, stick with us. The power of poison to hurt or kill us quietly, unseen, is terrifying. It's also a deep and wide part of nature, and the stuff of potent medicine, too. A new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History tells the story. This hour, On Point, the history, mystery, and science of poison. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you feel the old fascination? What's your experience with poison? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Mark Siddall, curator and professor at the American Museum of Natural History. Their big new exhibit, drawing lots of attention in the city and well beyond, is The Power of Poison. Mark Siddall, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. You make it sound so scary.
Scary and wonderful. I just loved reading about this. It's absolutely amazing. And, right up out of nature, why does poison exist in nature, Mark?
Well, poison exists in several forms in nature. We could take the inorganic things like mercury and lead that I think people are probably most familiar with. We think that one of the reasons why those things are poisonous is that they were locked in the Earth's crust and evolution simply had no opportunity to deal with it. That's very different than something like copper or iron or even cobalt that we use in our own bodies. Cobalt's in vitamin B12. Mm-hmm. In terms of animals or plants that have poisons, these are usually used for defensive purposes or for offensive purposes. They're really, in some respects, no different than claws or talons or body size and subject to the same forces of natural selection. We just don't see them with our eyes.
Give us a little bit of a tour. You've got golden poisonous frogs and a lot more here. Introduce us to some of these plants or animals and their poison and why they have that poison in particular.
Well, the very beginning of the exhibition, when you walk into it, we chose a particular place in the world rather than do a top 10 list of the top 10 most venomous snakes or the 10 most poisonous frogs or what have you. We picked one place, and that's the Colombian Choco Forest. It's a coastal rainforest, and it's where the golden poison frog lives. It's also the wettest inhabited place on the planet, it turns out. So it's very dark and foreboding and sort of captures that mood. The golden poison frog has these poisons in order to prevent things from eating it. And it's also very brightly colored. We see this quite a bit, in fact. Whether it's coral snakes or wasps, you get a lot of bright yellows and reds and blacks in contrast. This is something called aposematism. Obviously, it's only so valuable to be poisonous if everything is just going to eat you anyway because it doesn't recognize you. So being recognizable kind of goes hand in hand. In certain respects, we have venomous animals that are incredibly toxic in terms of their venom, but it's not because they're using it they certainly do use venoms as an offensive weapon against prey, but you get these really intense powers of poison, if you will, in these animals because something else is preying upon them and is resistant. A good example of that is the pit vipers, including rattlesnakes. And it turns out that they have incredibly powerful venoms because opossums feed on them with some impunity. They have a resistance.
What's the range of chemical profiles of poisons, the range of ways in which they would be a defensive or offensive weapon against a predator or a circumstance?
Yeah, sure. In fact, this goes to some definitional things. We tend to use poisonous or venomous to refer to the animal or the plant. We tend to use the word toxin in terms of what is the target. So, for example, there may be hemotoxins. These are things often that you'll find, for example, in snake venoms that interfere with the way blood clots. And so that's why they're called hemotoxins. Neurotoxins affect the nervous system, and that can happen in a whole variety of ways. You can turn nerves off or you can prevent them from turning off, or you can make them turn on in strange ways, or you can do all kinds of things. So neurotoxins is a very, very broad range of things. You also have what we call respiratory toxins. This isn't really about breathing. It's about cellular respiration and the ability to convert sugars, for example, into energy. And that's what arsenic and cyanide both do. They interfere with our ability to get energy from the stuff we eat, and they do it in all of our cells, which is what makes them very toxic.
So when Ponce de Leon died, I read somewhere here that something, was it an arrow or spear dipped in one of these? Do you know what that was?
It was an arrow, and it was a manchineal tree. Manchineal is a tree that occurs basically in the tropical parts of the New World, from Florida, so subtropical to tropical, Florida right down into South America. It's in the same family as poison ivy and poison oak, which is also the same family as mango. It's called the Anacardaceae. My wife, Megan, for example, cannot peel a mango because the skin of the mango will cause her to break out. So people have differential responses to it. But it turns out that the local people in Florida, when Ponce de Leon came ashore, didn't take very kindly to that, and they hit him with a poisoned arrow. The arrow was poisoned with sap from this manchineal tree. He made it back to Cuba and died a very painful death, I think, over the next couple of days.
1521, Ponce de Leon died in agony within days, died. Yet iguanas happily sleep in this tree's branches and eat its fruit. So what makes, you know, one creature vulnerable and another not? Maybe take this one in particular, the manchineal tree's poison.
The manchineal is poisonous to us, but not poisonous to an iguana. The poison ivy, obviously, is poisonous to us. We respond to it, and it turns out that black bears don't respond to it, and they're perfectly happy eating it. But this is true for a lot of things. Let's take chocolate. I'm very fond of chocolate.
Yeah.
I've got lots of friends that are fond of chocolate. And the active compound that gives us a bit of a boost, I suppose, is called theobromine. Theobroma is the name of the plant. It means food of the gods. And theobromine is the compound from it. It's not the same as caffeine. It's somewhat different. It was actually, interestingly enough, one of the compounds in those back pills from the, I think, 1960s and earlier, Doane's pills. Mm. I can say that because I don't think they're produced anymore. Anyway, theobromine is not toxic to us, obviously, but it certainly is very toxic to dogs, for example. You should not let your dogs eat chocolate, especially dark chocolate and baker's chocolate. It can actually be enough to seriously harm, if not kill, unfortunately, a very small dog like a Yorkie or a Jack Russell.
They can't handle the what? There's a kind of caffeine effect, or what is it that hits the dog?
I have to confess, I'm not an expert on all poisons, but I'm pretty sure what it does is it gives them liver damage.
And they just can't metabolize it quickly enough.
They can't metabolize it properly.
The
same thing happens with a lot of things. Your frontline defense, in us and dogs and other things, the frontline defense is your skin, your liver, and your kidneys in terms of detoxifying things. And if you overload them, then they can't handle it. This is one of the difficulties with acetaminophen, for example.
Giant silkworm caterpillars, and they've got hollow spines, and what, bleeding results if you're pricked by one of those? Why? What's the chemistry?
Yeah. I shouldn't be chuckling. Linomia is the name of the genus for the group. They're really actually quite beautiful, and they're very obvious to see. So getting stung by one requires a remarkable amount of lack of attention, I suppose. But this has happened. There was a woman, I believe, in South America who, while putting on her shoe, got stung very badly from one of these. And the poison, the toxin, is in fact hemotoxic. There's an interesting thing that happens with some hemotoxins. They're called procoagulative because they activate the clotting factors in blood, okay, which would make you think that you might throw a clot, for example. But
yeah,
in fact, it doesn't work that way. It actually, the way that they work is that by activating all of the clotting factors, there are no clotting factors left to do the job that needs to be done constantly. So, for example, your capillaries in your skin and your tissues, they're constantly clotting and unclotting in order to control the flow of blood and fluid into and out of your tissue. If you don't have any clotting factors, then you can't do that constant repair work and you bleed to death. You actually bleed out of your gums, you bleed out of your eyes, you bleed out of your fingernails, not unlike, for example, Ebola.
Great. You've got the scene from Macbeth you remind us of in the exhibit at the Natural History Museum. I mean, double-double, toil and trouble, and all the stuff they list off there. Clearly, humans have been fascinated by this whole realm of poison for a very long time, Shakespeare included.
Yeah, indeed. And he obviously has some other instances where poison comes into play in Romeo and Juliet in the final scene. And the interesting thing that I – and this is something that I like to point out about the Macbeth situation. So you have the three witches. They're using all of these things. Tooth of hound, for example, is not really from a dog. It's another name for a plant, hound's tooth. There are slips of you and other things. But that poison is actually never used as a poison.
We got to take a short break. We'll look down through that recipe, wool of bat and adder's fork and lizard's leg. Mark Siddall is with the American Museum of Natural History. Their big new exhibit is The Power of Poison. Here's Beyoncé's Poison. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Breaking all of my defenses with time. You're just like poison, and I just don't get it. How could something so deadly feel so right?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the history, mystery, and science of poison in nature, myth, murder, and even medicine. Mark Siddall is with us. He is curator and professor at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. They've got a big new exhibit through next summer, next August. It is The Power of Poison. It's double-double toil and trouble with Shakespeare's witches, but also with his Romeo and Juliet. Here from Baz Luhrmann's 96 adaptation of the classic, Leonardo DiCaprio as Romeo purchasing the poison that will take his life from the apothecary.
Let me have a dram of poison, such soon-speeding gear as will disperse itself through all the veins that the life-weary taker may fall dead.
Such mortal drugs I have, but Verona laws death, any he that utters them.
The world is not thy friend.
And it's not just back in Romeo Shakespeare's time. Here from Breaking Bad, chemistry teacher turned meth cook Walter White makes a poison as a way to kill a threatening drug dealer in this scene. Walter, played by Bryan Cranston, explains the plan to his partner, Jesse Pinkman, played by Aaron Paul.
Beans. Beans. They're castor beans.
So what are we going to do with them? Are we just going to grow a magic beanstalk? Huh? Climb it and escape?
We are going to process them into ricin.
Ricin beans.
Ricin. It's an extremely effective poison. It's toxic in small doses. Also fairly easy to overlook during an autopsy.
From Breaking Bad, Mark Siddall is with us from the American Museum of Natural History. His own research looks at the evolution of leeches. We can talk leech venom here and blood-feeding behavior as well. Mark, here's a listener who, quoting, we have smart listeners, quoting Paracelsus, saying, everything is poison. There is poison in everything. Only the dose makes a thing not a poison. And some parts of what we learn in your exhibit seems to support that. I mean, you look back at cinnamon and chili peppers and coffee and tea and toxic, and, you know, we love them, but wrong dose, and you can be in trouble.
Yeah, Paracelsus had that idea. It was interesting that he had quite a few followers in the medical profession. There's a really interesting story that goes with that. One of his most strident followers was a gentleman by the name of Maffei in London, who was admitted to the College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he thought that spiders, for example, which all of which are venomous, could be used to cure anything from pink eye to bad humor and so on. He had a daughter named Patience, who he worked on quite a bit. Mm. And this is the origin of the rhyme, Little Miss Muffet, who sat on her tuffet.
With her curds and
with their curds away. In fact, Maffei, the physician, had written a book about nutrition, and one of the chapters was indeed about curds and whey.
So did he succeed in helping her with spider venom?
We don't know. Presumably she ran away.
you do have a whole portion on how poison has been brought into medical science. Vampire bat saliva with its anti-clotting agent, Draculin no less, protecting stroke patients. What else there?
Well, in fact, interestingly enough, and because I work on leeches, I'll give them a little shout out here.
Yeah.
One of the very first compounds ever isolated from an animal for medical purposes was something called Hirudin. It's an anti-clotting agent. It isn't used very much anymore. It's used in certain special cases. But it was responsible for a guy named Jörg Haas completing the very first human dialysis treatment. He lined the tubing to keep the blood from clotting with Hirudin. Lots of other things are out there. One of the more recent ones is, in fact, a compound from the venom of the Gila monster. The Gila monster is a beautiful lizard that lives in the desert southwest of the United States. It has a compound in its venom that, when it bites its prey, a small mouse, for example, causes a precipitous drop in blood glucose levels. And someone figured out, wow, we could probably harness this and use it for type 2 diabetes. And in fact, it's now, I think, a $700 million a year drug.
I mean, we're reading about more here. Cone snails might be used for treating epilepsy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, beautiful shells that we see coming up from the seafloor. The venom of pit vipers, maybe for blood pressure drugs, spider venom, maybe in treatments for breast cancer. Is it the very toxicity that somehow is making – well, it's certainly the chemical interaction that's making these valuable as medicines.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And quite frankly, the difference between a poison and a drug is just the physiological process you're trying to stop. But poison is something that interferes with a physiology we would rather it not interfere with, whereas a drug interferes with a physiology that we need interfering with. And in fact, when you go back to the origins of the Greek origins of some of these words, toxicon was a poison that you would apply to something sharp, be it a sword or an arrow or a spear. And the word for a poison that you would give to somebody, like the hemlock, for example, given to Socrates, was pharmakon, from which we get pharmacology, of course.
Incredible stories and incredible adaptations. You remind us of this arms race in nature, grasshopper mice, which co-opt the venom of the bark scorpion, which they like to eat, I guess, to numb their own nerve endings and not feel pain from the scorpion's sting.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? In fact, what's really cool about that particular story is that it was only published in scientific literature in the last month or so. And we knew that it was going to happen. We knew about the story, and we managed to incorporate that into the exhibition in the Coevolution Theater. That arms race is referred to as the Red Queen hypothesis in evolution, because if you remember Alice, when she meets the Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass, she's running and running and running. And you can run faster, but if you run faster, you don't get anywhere more quickly. You just can't then run slower, because if you do, you'll fall backwards. And this is what's going on in these competitive arms races between resistant animals like grasshopper mice and the very powerful venoms of the bark scorpion.
We're looking at poison with Mark Sidall. He is at the Natural History Museum in New York. A lot of callers for you, Mark. Dave in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. Thanks for the moment here.
Yeah.
30 years ago, when I was 17 years old, I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with my family, mother, father, sisters, etc., and I encountered a Portuguese man of war. And my body was covered probably 33 or probably one-third, they said, percent coverage by this jellyfish. And it's my understanding now that it delivers a neurotoxin, and I happen to have a reaction to it. And I can tell you that as a result of that experience, I would never, ever go in the water down in Florida or really anywhere down south of Georgia again. And I basically experienced the full gamut of, the onset of this toxin right up to full paralysis and near death. I mean, I stopped breathing and could feel my heart was stopping, and we luckily got to some help.
There's poison right up out of the sea. Dave, you make it very vivid. What happened there, Mark? As David was suffering that from the Portuguese man of war, the jellyfish, what was going on?
Well, first, I want to just make a small point. First of all, I'm glad that you're okay. Secondly, the Portuguese Man of War, interestingly enough, it is in the same broader group of things we call jellyfish, but it is not, in fact, a jellyfish.
Okay.
There are jellyfish, of course, that are individuals and have long tentacles. The Portuguese Man of War, weirdly, is a colony of multiple organisms, only a few of which have the long tendrils. One of them makes that big bulbous gassy thing that it uses as a sail, and they're called siphonophores. That little peculiarity doesn't help in terms of making someone feel better about their stings, I'm afraid. The interesting thing about Portuguese man of wars, these siphonophores, is that they often occur in large blooms. It's very rare to find one at a time. When you see them washed up on the beach, there'll be a whole bunch of them. And if you encounter them out in the ocean, notwithstanding that they're small, there will be a possibly quite a large number of them. And it sounds like the gentleman was hit by the stinging tentacles. Those stinging tentacles are used by the Portuguese man of war for feeding. It's for hunting. As small fish, for example, get caught in the tendrils, they get stunned by the neurotoxins and they get brought up. But it is quite painful, yes.
And this is all neurotoxin that was shutting down Dave's system?
There may have been a lot of different things going on. I'm sure there was some neurotoxicity. My guess is that there was probably an enormous amount of inflammation. Often some of the pathology that we get is because our immune system responds to these things as foreign, which mm-hmm, they are, mm-hmm. And then you get really bad inflammation and sometimes even anaphylaxis. I believe that there's been at least one fatality from Portuguese man of war. It was someone who was swimming and came up to the surface through a huge bloom. And I believe that the cause of death was actually an anaphylactic response, an immune response.
Well, Dave, glad you made it through. Anne in Frankfurt, Michigan. Frankfurt, Anne, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom and Mark. When I lived in California a few years ago, I was taking a plant study, and I got poison oak. And one of the teachers said, the remedy for that is grows near the plant itself, and that turned out to be manzanita, which is a shrub that grows near the oaks, near the poison oak, I mean. So my question is, how common is it that the remedy or a remedy grows near the plant, and why or how would that develop?
Interesting. What do you think, Mark?
That's actually an idea that was quite prominent during the time of exploration, maybe the 1600s and 1700s, the notion that the remedy for a particular toxin would occur nearby. It's not necessarily the case. I'm sure that there are plenty of random cases where that does occur, but it would simply be at random. There is an interesting story that goes with that. Strychnos nux vomica is the origin of the seeds of this particular plant. Is the origins of strychnine. You grind up the seeds and you get strychnine. And interestingly enough, the paralytic effects of that are sort of what we call a tonic-clonic paralysis. Everything clenches up. And so an antidote would be something that would make you relax. And curare does that, and curare comes from Strychnos toxifera. So two different plants closely related with completely opposite effects in terms of their neurotoxicity, and Strychnos toxifera is an antidote to Strychnos nux vomica, but they don't actually grow side by side.
Lots of interesting symbiosis, though. We'll talk about the devil's garden here and more. We're looking at the history and mystery and science of poison with Mark Siddall of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Mark, stand by. I want to bring Deborah Blum into our conversation from Madison, Wisconsin, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer and journalism professor, also author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age, New York. Deborah Blum, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us today. I think you did some advising on this exhibit in New York. Poison is your thing, and here it is, front and center for all the world to learn about, Deborah.
I know. This is such a wonderful time of my life. Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. It's great to be here.
Oh, the wonders of poison. You write in your wonderful book, The Poisoner's Handbook, about that period in which people had access to a lot of poisons, but there wasn't really very good science or forensic science on tracking them down, kind of murderer's heyday until that got reined in, Deborah.
That's exactly right. I mean, we they take for granted what I think of as a kind of CSI age. Mm-hmm. But if you go back, say, to the 19th century, people used to call that the golden age of poisoners, because there's all these wonderful poisons that Mark has described out there, and you can use them, and scientists don't know how to find them in the body. So it's a period in which we see much heavier use of poison by murder than we do today, although we still see it today. And we see serial poisoners. There was a woman, Mary Ann Cotton, in England, who poisoned 21 people with arsenic before she was caught.
Wow. I mean, talk about symbiosis. There were human murderers and poisons fit together like hand in glove, dealing with heirs who wanted their fortunes and unhappy spouses who wanted free, or just psychopaths. What was the profile of the person who went for poison as the murder weapon, Deborah?
I mean, I love the idea of poisons and homicidal poisoners being a great match, because poisons have such a devious chemistry, and poisoners are planners and plotters, right? It's the only homicidal weapon in which you can never kill by impulse. You don't say, well, I'm mad at you, so I'm going to go research the best poison, and 2 weeks later it'll be in your oatmeal. You plot and you plan. And so poisoners in the 19th century loved arsenic, say, because it was tasteless and odorless and non-detectable. And today we see people using poisons in a way that they always think they're going to get away with it, and fortunately don't always do.
Mark, you have elements of this in the exhibit as well at the Museum of Natural History. Was there truly a time when the poisoners could get away scot-free? It was undetectable by forensic science such as it was?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, what we do in the exhibition is we take you through a rogue's gallery of villains and victims, where we don't answer the question whether or not these people were poisoners necessarily, or were they poisoned. That's then the introduction to what I think is one of the highlights of our exhibition, and that's a forensic toxicology theater set in the late 1800s, early 1900s. We're not very specific about that. And we go through what arguably was the very first, if not one of the first, cases of forensic toxicology being brought to jurisprudence. The case of John Bodle, who poisoned his grandfather literally to inherit the farm, and the attempt afterwards then to create a test to detect arsenic and bringing that to trial. Deborah, do you cover that in the book? I think you do.
I do, because the first poison that scientists learned how to find in a body was arsenic, because they were so determined. It was so widely used. And that test came about 1840 or so. It was invented by a slightly enraged British chemist, James Marsh, who had sort of been outwitted by a poisoner. And what's really interesting is then, as scientists learn how to detect these metallic mineral poisons, you actually see this sort of devious pattern of poisoners shifting to plant poisons, because they're not detectable.
Deborah Blum, stand by. We've got to take a break right here. Mark Sedell at the Museum of Natural History. Tom Waits.
Did the devil make the world while God was sleeping? You'll never get a wish from a bone. Another wrong goodbye and 100 sailors. That deep blue sky is my home, and she left in the fall. It's a picture on the wall. She always had that little drop of poison.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the history, mystery, and science of poison in nature, myth, murder, and medicine. Mark Siddall is with us from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Their big new exhibit is The Power of Poison, looking at poison from all kinds of angles, literary, scientific, the medical breakthroughs that have come with poison, and much more. Deborah Blum joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. She's author of The Poisoner's Handbook, did some advising on this wonderful big new exhibit, and can tell you all about the great age of poisoning and how it was finally reined in, does so in her book. Deborah, Mark, stand by. Greg's calling from Nashville. Greg, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question about wormwood. It's what they use in absinthe, and it was just, I think, allowed in the United States in 2011. And the main ingredient in it, I think, is called thujone, and it gives you kind of a lucid feeling, and people have been known to, like, go crazy after drinking it. And I would just like to know a little bit more about that, if somebody has used that as a poison, or, you know, they use it in absinthe. Now, can you... I just want some information.
Sure, let us see what we know here. Mark, how about it? Wormwood and absinthe. I mean, first of all, what do you know about that? And then it kind of raises the question of, what is poison? I mean, if some people drink it for pleasure and it drives others a little wiggy, is it poison?
Now, wormwood's an interesting case. The absinthe got a lot of bad rap for having wormwood in it. And wormwood does have toxins in it, like most plants do. Most of the effects were probably from overconsumption and the alcohol in the absinthe itself. That being said, wormwood is now a different wormwood from Asia is actually exploited for the production of an anti-malarial compound called artemisinin that is sort of the one of the newer drugs that we have to combat malaria. And again, it just goes back to the issue of what is a poison in one context could be useful in another context.
Gets to this definition. How do you define poison? Mark, when, you know, some of these are being used for medicine and some are harmful to one animal and not another, how do you do it? What are the boundaries of your realm here?
Well, interestingly, there is something called a therapeutic index, and that is the ratio of what it takes to give a desired effect, so the efficacy of something, relative to the amount that you would take, for example, that would have a toxic effect. And obviously, if the therapeutic effect occurs at a higher dose than a toxic effect, you can't use it as a drug. If the ratio is large enough, so it takes 10 times or more, for example, to have a toxic effect, then you've got a nice therapeutic index and you can use it for whatever the effective purpose is. I'm not recommending this right now, but interestingly enough, if you take something like a psychedelic, psilocybin in magic mushrooms, the therapeutic effect, that is the high, if you will, occurs at a very, very small dose measured in picograms or femtograms. The lethal dose at which, the median lethal dose at which you would affect maybe 50% of the people taking this and maybe cause them to die from the toxicity of psilocybin is equivalent to eating 15 pounds of magic mushrooms in one sitting.
Maybe that's too much. Deborah Blum, you say people moved to plant-based poisons when that became the safer path for the murderer. Like what?
Morphine and nicotine. Actually, the first plant poison discovered in a corpse was nicotine. It was a guy who stewed tobacco leaves in a barn on his property to kill his brother-in-law. And the thing about that is these were so easy to get at the time. I mean, our history of using this is so fascinating. So morphine was in babies' teething solutions, for instance. And strychnine was in pick-me-up tonics. And arsenic was in cosmetic preparations. And on the point of arsenic, I just want to make one point, which is that there are compounds that are bad for you no matter what the dose. Mm-hmm. So arsenic will kill you at a high dose. But if you look at, like, the modern science of low-dose toxicology, you can find it doing harm at the part per billion level. I mean, there are some...
And this is an issue in water supplies and more around the country.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So you can say there are some things that seem to have no redeeming qualities at all.
Yeah, I agree.
On the redeeming quality front, well, yeah, it all depends what you're using it for, I guess. Ned in Hartford, Connecticut. Ned, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm wondering about the immunization value of poisons. I used to get poison ivy as a child very badly, and now as an adult, I don't seem to be as susceptible to it. I think it was maybe Napoleon who kept taking little bits of poison so because he was afraid someone would poison him.
You know, people used to do that with arsenic. There were actually the arsenic eaters of a portion of Austria who would spread a little arsenic paste on their toast in the morning to try to build up a... I wouldn't recommend that.
No.
But, right, there's like this long theory that you can habituate to a poison. We see it with drinking, right? You habituate to alcohol, right? The more you drink, the more your body processes that more efficiently. But it's a risky area. Agreed on poison ivy, though, it looks like, and Mark probably knows more about this than me, that you can sort of get a reduced response in some cases
and a greater one
in others.
What about the individual? Mark? Yeah, the individual that he's referring to is actually King Mithridates, who had a concoction that he would take a little bit every day in order to prevent him from dying should he ever be poisoned. It's pretty clear that that doesn't really work that well. Something like arsenic, for example, you can have an acute dose that's very large and that will kill you very quickly. But very, very small doses will simply just kill you over a much longer time period. Interestingly enough, with poison ivy, what's going on is you're actually immunologically responding to it. It's your immune system that gives you all the blisters and the long-term rash and all of the pain. And it is interesting that there is some evidence that people can develop not an immunity. In fact, that's not what you want. What you want is tolerance. You want to not be immune to it. You want to not respond to it. And that will be much more pleasant when you encounter poison ivy. There is some evidence, and I really don't know how anybody figured this out, that if you eat poison ivy, it may give you a tolerance to it if you encounter it on your skin.
Oh,
I
good
can't
luck.
Imagine anybody
that.
Wanting to test
Let's
that.
Be clear.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. And the Napoleon poison link, you reference that in the exhibit.
Yeah, we do. Napoleon was convinced he was being poisoned. And
when he was in exile...
When he was in St. Helena, he thought that the British were poisoning him slowly, and he wasn't necessarily sure what it was. People have since then taken samples of hair and so forth and found rather large amounts of arsenic in tissue samples, in hair samples that were from Napoleon. But a lot of people had a lot of exposure to arsenic at that time. There were arsenical compounds in medicines, just like little bits of strychnine were used in medicines. Little bits of mercury were used in things like calomel. We would never do that today. So it's hard to know whether or not that was just standard exposure. In fact, even the green pigments in the wallpaper in his room in St. Helena had arsenical compounds in it.
Deborah Blum, this issue of poisoning and political figures has been in the news again just lately with Yasser Arafat and the Swiss and more looking at his remains. You've paid attention to that. What did you see there?
I think we love the idea of political assassination. And the Yasser Arafat case was really brought up by the Qatar-based news service Al Jazeera, suggesting that he had been, that there was evidence of contamination by a radioactive element, polonium-210, first in his personal effects, and then the same laboratory found it in his, found evidence of it in his body. But my own take on that is that while we love these ideas and while it's a great news story, this was a bad poison to hang a case on because polonium-210 is a highly active radioactive material. It burns out through its half-life in 138 days. So all the actual science is iffy, and what it really tells us is that what we see on TV, solve it in an hour, is not what we're going to see in real life.
Let's go to Paul, calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, Mark, Deborah, how are you?
Well.
I can't wait to see this exhibit. Swing down to New York and check it out. Hey, I was diving in the Red Sea between Egypt and Saudi Arabia one night, around midnight, and came across a textile cone snail moving across the sand, and as a result, when I was photographing it, became interested in cone snail venoms. And Mark, as you know, zinconotide is now used as a painkiller in the form of a drug called, I think it's called Prialt. But it had some side effects, and also it synthesized a small small molecule, so it can be synthesized. You don't have to go out and collect cone snails. My question to you is, do you anticipate refinement of these molecules that are used medicinally to, this one is used when morphine no longer works. Do you anticipate the use of these molecules once the side effects can be under control, or the molecule modified?
Yeah, from cone snails and more, Mark, what about the medical upside here?
Well, there are a lot of different compounds that we can get from animals, and ziconotide, for example, is one of them. And you're quite correct on all counts there that it's being used in extreme cases of pain. One of the issues with that particular drug is that it is a peptide. So it's made up of amino acids. This is just the way that the cone snail creates its venom, as opposed to a very small molecule. As such, if you inject it into a person like you would, for example, morphine, it'll probably be very quickly removed by your immune system. So it's used in things like spinal taps or directly into the central nervous system, which makes it a very difficult drug to use, and you would only use it in very extreme cases. The truth is that there has been this very long evolutionary history of cone snails and their relatives that are called cerebrid snails. Mandy Holford, who works at the American Museum of Natural History and the City University of New York, is examining some of the diversity of these different compounds. We probably don't have to do the fine-tuning of these individual poisons and toxins and venoms because evolution has done that for us already. We need to simply go out there and find out what they are and find out what their effects are and how they're doing it differentially on their own.
Paul, thanks for calling. Janet's calling from Kent, Ohio. Janet, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I am curious about Coumadin. When I was caring for my mother, she had had stroke issues and was on Coumadin.
The blood thinner. Mm-hmm.
Yes. It was a very touchy thing to administer, and I believed she got a spider bite, which just completely threw this out of whack, and tripped to emergency to deal with the results. And so I'm just curious about that situation.
Mark, what about a little spider venom on top of Coumadin? Can you imagine an interaction?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. It's certainly interesting from a medical point of view. There are a lot of complications that can happen when you're on any particular drug, for example, Coumadin, of course, being one of them, and a whole bunch of other things that we take for depression or what have you. So I can't answer directly because I don't know the science that's involved. I would be surprised if the physicians at the local hospital weren't really intrigued by that.
You've got more plants that you describe the effects of in the exhibit. Belladonna, monk's hood, wolf's bane. Give us some sense of the range of effects of these.
Well, plants are really interesting because effectively, whether you're a plant on land or a sponge in the ocean, you can't run away. So you must be protecting yourself with something. And almost invariably, that's a poison of some sort. And there are plenty of poisons out there. Belladonna gets its name because people in the region of the Mediterranean, women, were using it, dripping extracts of this plant into their eyes in order to relax their pupils and give them great big huge doe-eyed pupils that were thought to be pretty, and hence the name Belladonna.
Yeah.
Interestingly, that has the exact opposite effect of something like an organophosphate poisoning from something like sarin gas or from malathion or what have you. You get very tight constriction of the pupils. And to this day, extracts from belladonna, or the very same compound, we manufacture it now. Atropine is one of the frontline defenses against such chemical poisoning.
And then the devil's garden, where what African ants use poison to sort of cultivate the crop they want?
Yeah, it's actually in South America.
Excuse me.
I don't know that there are these in Africa. There might be something very similar to it. There are a lot of different plants around the world that create what we call domatia. They create homes for ants, and the ants protect the plants. In the case of the Devil's Garden, you have the tacoca plant, and it creates a domatia that these tiny little ants live in. In addition to protecting the plants against herbivores, those ants will go down to the ground and inject their formic acid into the base of any other plant that tries to grow in the same area. So you have these huge monodominant regions all covered with just this one species of plant all covered with ants.
Deborah Blum, our time is so short, but clearly our fascination is deep here. We feel and have known for a long time about all the power that lies here. I mean, they call it the power of poison for a reason. It really appeals to our dark imaginations.
It does. I think we're fascinated by the way these chemicals kind of weave a dark story through our life and always want to know more. And I think this exhibit is so exciting.
Going right on through August. Who's coming, Mark? Have you got your, I don't know, did you have, murderous-looking types lurking in the hallway of the American Museum of Natural History now?
Not at all. Deborah is absolutely correct that poison and our relationship to it weaves this really wonderful tapestry through storytelling. One of the things that we hope is that people will come through the exhibition, and as they go out the far end, they'll wonder what book are they going to read next.
Well, you've given us a good start right here, and it is a fascinating universe. Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, thank you so much for being with us from Madison, Wisconsin today, Deborah.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
And Mark Siddall at the American Museum of Natural History. The big exhibit is The Power of Poison. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Come and enjoy the show.
We'll go out with the coasters. You know the song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You'll be scratching like a hound the minute you start to mess around.
Poison.